CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing funding drive donors. Thank you so much.
Mondays can be a tough day, but would you like something to brighten up your Monday afternoon? Well, tune in to my show, Dark Glasses, on CFRC 101.9. My name's Daniel Wolf, and the show is now in its 14th year with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
Hey, this is Begonia, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, my 2022 interview on a film whose influence ranges from pop culture to American politics and is the first adult film to debut in mainstream cinema, breaking box office records back in 1972. The film, Deep Throat. All that and more coming up, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Journey through Rainbow Country, as I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading. But ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, Deep Throat, a film written and directed by Gerard Damiano, who passed away in 2008. In 2022, this iconic adult film celebrated its 50th anniversary. During my interview, I was joined by the adult children of director Gerard Damiano, Gerard Damiano Jr., Christar Damiano, as well as artist and businessperson Robin Leonardi. We'll find out about 50 years of Deep Throat, including the film's influence on American politics, and so much more. Plus, in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, British author Adam Smith reads from his gay history book, Deep Sniff, a history of paupers, and Queer Futures. By the way, the reading is accompanied by the parody song, Just a Quick Sniff of Poppers, from drag duo Cookie and Kashida.
When I was just a lad, I learned that anal sex was bad. The church said it was a dirty, rotten sin. But then I learned from other guys that no matter what the size, there's a simple trick to help you take that tick. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in. The penis slides right in, you can take it with a grin. Just a quick snip of poppers helps the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
In the winter of 1866, actually, while a medical student in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, Brunton met a patient called William H. This young man was only 26, but already had trained as a blacksmith, and then switched to tollkeeper. His first job may have required too much exertion for him to continue because Brunton's notes reveal that William suffered from heart trouble. When Brunton met him, William had recently been hit by a dull, heavy pain about the left nipple every 3 days or so, lasting for at least half an hour. The pain had come on after years of infrequent attacks ever since he'd suffered from rheumatism as a child. After a 3-week hospital stay earlier in the spring, William was back just before Christmas. Doctors gave him aconite, which slows the heart rate, and digitalis. When neither worked, Brunton gave him brandy. The strong stuff didn't help either, so there was only one thing for it. The experiment was not a stab in the dark. Brunton acted in a way that was consistent with his wishes to take basic research from the lab to the bedside, and only with a decent understanding of the actual effect in the body. He had read the work of another scientist, Richardson, that amyl nitrite dilated blood vessels, and had even discussed the effect with his colleague in Edinburgh, Arthur Gamgee, who had made some unpublished measurements of this effect. Brunton obtained some amyl nitrite from Gamgee, who made it for him, and consent for an experiment from his supervising physician. And this is how Brunton came to give his patient William amyl nitrite. On March the 12th, 1867, Brunton observed, "The pain came on as usual at 3 a.m. A few drops of nitrite of amyl were put on a towel and inhaled by the patient. The primary effect noticed was a suffusion of the face, and the patient felt a glow over his face and chest. The pain disappeared almost simultaneously with the occurrence of these phenomena, but returned in 3 minutes. He then inhaled 5 drops more. The pain again disappeared and did not return."
I met this guy once in a bar who took me outside to his car. He spread my cheeks and tried to ram it in. I screamed, "No, it's too big." He said, "Take it all, you pig." Then he shoved this small brown bottle up my nose. And girl, I gotta tell you something. That quick sniff of poppers helped the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in. Now I can take it with a grin. Just a quick sniff of poppers helped the penis slide right in. In the most delightful way.
Good queer performers push their audiences forward into the future they desire. A good performance is utopia for a moment. In the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, all of these potential utopias were willed away when the police stormed in. Performances interrupted, orgasms foregone, connections broken. The police brought their alternative performance. The police did not just want to stop what was happening, they wanted to make their own utopia for a moment. They pulled on their costumes and they put themselves to work on embodying authority, power, intimidation. As individual officers, people with homes and hobbies, they had been moved by some newspaper stories about a deadly sex craze and by others that spoke of a horrible illness killing men who had sex with each other. They heard the words of politicians who spoke about preserving families and protecting children. As individuals, they may even have wanted no more gay or queer people. As an organized group of individuals, each wanting to belong to something bigger than they were, police officers were grabbed by the idea of cutting the number of queer venues. All we have is the records of their group performance, the way they stopped gay and queer people. They arrested our futures, at least for a night or two. The story of these raids is a story from the past, but it is about how we live in the present, creating a future. In every moment we are performing, making choices about the future we want to build for ourselves and others. We can be inspired by other people who are better than us at articulating a future, but it is not some distant, formless thing. How we are living now is always creating a future, whether we like it or not. Whether or not we are trying, we are performing a future. As a genderqueer dancer stretches the limbs they have, they bring us into their utopia for a moment.
Wow, this stuff is amazing.
Yeah, let me try some. I've never done it before.
Wow, this is hot.
Oh, shit.
Hey, Cookie, let's put something in my ass and see if it works.
I just dropped the whole thing on the carpet. Here, bend over. Let me try this chair.
Oh, my God, I can't even feel anything.
Shit, the whole thing fits.
Wow, the room is spinning right now. These are great, but you know what? You can't use them if you're taking Viagra.
Why?
Well, because you'll die.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Wow, this stuff is amazing. So this goes out to all the guys who are too concerned with size. It really doesn't matter anymore.
As you watch his manhood grow, shove that bottle up your nose. Relax,
relax
your hole,
your hole,
and slide down on that pole.
Just a twist with a bubble tuck, the penis slide right in, the penis slide right in. You can take it with a grin. Just a quick slip of bubble tuck, the penis slide right in
the most delightful,
making it not frightful.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a Sin City reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
When I return,
deep throat. Starting off with the writer and director himself, Gerard Damiano.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
The first time that anyone ever treated sex openly, honestly, humorously, as though we were doing nothing that we had to be ashamed about. It shows you if you're gay, it's okay to be gay. If you're heterosexual, it's okay to be heterosexual. Whatever it is that you feel like you want to do, whatever it is, don't be ashamed of it. Deep Throat did that.
Of you to Gerard Jr., to Christar, to Robin. Thank you all for being here to have your voices, your stories be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for that. Gerard Jr., you are a filmmaker, you are a visual artist. Talk to me about your visual art, first of all. How would you describe the art that you do, your visual style?
Well, I've always been visually oriented since I was a child. I always liked to draw. And when I was very, very young, my father saw what I was drawing and he said, you should be drawing storyboards. And I was maybe, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old. So he kind of showed me the format, you know, like on these comic strips. And so I've been, you know, very, very interested in visual arts my whole life. I went to Rhode Island School of Design and studied illustration. I've illustrated, you know, books and posters and all kinds of things, but also have worked as a filmmaker. And I feel that, you know, film, they call it, we just came from Cannes, they refer to it as the seventh art. And I've always felt that that film and filmmaking kind of encompasses and incorporates all the arts together, because it's not just visual, you introduce audio, you have story, you have different actors and so forth. And so it's very collaborative and brings in all the arts together. So I, you know, made adult films. I worked alongside my father and learned the craft right on the set the way he did. Went on to make films, but after having worked with him on film, you know, I hesitate to say film, in reference to some of the shot on video features that I was involved in later. When video happened, the market became glutted with content, the quality really fell apart. And so, you know, I stopped working on those films, not because I had any trouble with the subject matter, but because there was really no room for artistic expression. It was just about, can you do this quicker and cheaper and so on. So currently I'm involved in, I've been working on a documentary film about our father and his career. Deep Throat was just one chapter in his story. And we feel that his own story is very compelling because, you know, he went on to make much better films. He, you know, the work that he did touched so many people in so many different ways, you know, and not everybody was for, you know, for him. He had a lot of detractors and was prosecuted, you know, by the U.S. government, by the religious right and so forth. And, you know, there are so many things that he dealt with 50 years ago that he would never dream that we'd still be fighting these same fights today. And so we've had this opportunity to restore the film, which we feel is an important film. He would tell you it's not a good film. Okay. He never pretended that it was a very good film. He felt that it was the best that they could do at the time. They were a young crew. My father had just been learning on the set. This was the fourth film that he made and the most ambitious. They were all very proud to be shooting in 35 millimeter color, which, you know, most people don't have a conception of that today. But when you talk about Deep Throat, it's still considered to be the most profitable film of all time. And that's not to say that it made more money than the Titanic or Black Panther or whatever, but compared to the cost of making the film, the return on the investment, no other film has come close. But my father would be, you know, really proud to say that for $25,000, which was the, you know, and I think that that might have been even included the marketing and advertising, you know, but it was, you know, under $25,000 that the film was made for. It made so much money, but he would be, you know, quick to say most of that money was spent on film and processing, because you could get actors and actresses to work for next to nothing, but, you know, you had to pay Kodak cash on the barrelhead, he would say, that you couldn't get film for free, and it certainly wasn't cheap to process it. So most of that $25,000 went to make the actual film, to process the negative, to make the print, and so on. And that most of the people that worked on the film went to Miami on their own dime. They paid their own way. They drove down to be involved in this process because they were proud to be making a 35 millimeter film. They were excited to be involved.
Cristar Damiano, you and Gerard Jr., you guys are siblings. You are also a filmmaker. You're also a sound healer. Well done. Talk to me about those early days when your dad was making Deep Throat. How would you describe those times, those days, those early days?
Well, it was very happy times for us as a family because we were so close as a family. Our parents never really kept anything secret from us, so we knew exactly what was happening. We kind of watched our dad career blossom, and as he became more famous, it was more exciting for us. Unfortunately, with his fame didn't come very much money, but it was exciting for us to see that our dad was very passionate about what he was doing and that he got the opportunity to make a difference in the world and really change. At the time, he was the start of the sexual revolution. So I was very proud to call him my dad.
Mm. Robin Leonardi, hello.
Hello, Mark.
You are an artist. You are a business person. Talk to me about how you know the Damiano.
Okay, so I know Gerard Jr. and Cristar Damiano. Because my mother was a pornographer. My mother was a pioneer in the adult film industry. And an activist. And so my mother and Gerard Sr. were colleagues. They were contemporaries. They collaborated on several projects together during the course of their career. And Gerard and Cristar and I reunited after many years of having kind of, you know, going our own way and growing up. And then we realized we lived about an hour away from each other here in Florida. Coincidences of coincidences. And then consequently, we kind of bonded. We became very good friends. We would spend Christmases and Thanksgiving and most of our holidays together, kind of like as the family that I never had because I was a, you know, an only child. And then about 6 months or so ago, Gerard and I were having a conversation and he was sharing with me his desire to bring a restored version of this iconic film to commemorate and honor his father on the anniversary of its 50th premiere. And I happened to say, well, you know, let me know if I can help. And he said, well, no, I don't want you to just help. Like, I want you to come work with
Educate.
I want you to come work with me on this. So we've spent the past 4 months pretty much, just nose to the grindstone, bringing awareness of the film to the masses. You know, it's a film that people often will talk about, and it's iconic, but not a lot of people really know about it. And so we're trying to again, like you say, educate for certain. And Gerard and I, because our parents were in the same industry, we have a lot in common. And I know that he's passionate about telling his father's story and about restoring his films so that they can be seen in the manner they were intended when they were originally made. And so I wanted to, work together with him to help bring that vision to fruition.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. We're not later, I think.
No, you're just in time.
Fine.
You'll have number 11.
You're welcome.
You'll have 12.
Oh.
Just have a drink, sit down, relax, wait until your number's called.
What are we doing, holding a raffle here? I never win anything anyway.
Don't worry, honey. Everybody gets a little piece of this action.
We felt, and, I'm speaking for my sister as well as myself, we felt that it was important to preserve our father's film because it was, it's really transcended film. We're not just talking about a movie. We're talking about a film that touched on so many different things in terms of the laws surrounding obscenity, the mafia's involvement of the film that had its own spin where the film was prosecuted in that respect. There's been a lot of scandal about the film since it first came out. And we felt that whether you want to see it or not, you should have the right to see the film. And we wanted to preserve and restore the film so that you'd have the opportunity to see it the way our father had originally intended. Over the years, it's been bootlegged, it's been manipulated in different ways, things have been added, things have been taken away. We feel that it's important to present this film, at this time as what we consider event cinema, that we're not streaming it, we're not selling it for theatrical release and to wide audience. We're appearing and presenting the film ourselves. We understand that part of the importance of Deep Throat is that it really sparked a public dialogue, and it had people talking about sex and sexuality, about female empowerment, about female orgasm, and so forth. And so we want to present the film in such a way as to we invite questions from the audience. We have moderated talkbacks with panelists, and we can have historians that can put it in context. Christar and I will be available to answer questions about what we know of the truth of the making of the film. We can represent our father's perspective on it, and then open up to questions from the audience. And people are very curious about some of the stuff. There have been a lot of misinformation over the years about the film, and we see this as an opportunity to reopen that dialogue again, pose some of the same questions and really examine, where we're at now 50 years later, because there were some struggles that our father had with censorship, his right to expression, that we're still fighting those battles today. And, our father, I think, would be amazed had he lived to see the 50th anniversary, that we haven't, as a culture and as a species, evolved beyond this point right now, that we still, have this hypocrisy and this puritanism in the United States.
And on that note, we will return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell, and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Robin, this film came out in 1972, was part of the sexual revolution, also part of the golden age of porn. Talk to me about what the golden age of porn was, because your mom was also involved in this time as well.
Yes, my mother was in a iconic film, equally as well, maybe not equally. There is no other film that can hold a candle to the notoriety around the film Deep Throat. But she appeared in a film in 1975 called Misty Beethoven, actually the opening of Misty Beethoven, which has become a cult classic as well, and which plays in art houses to this day. And really, I think there was this whole porno chic culture, which Gerard Jr. can speak to, that was actually a term coined during an interview that his father had with a journalist from the New York Times.
The New York Times, yes.
In the early 1970s. So the golden age of porn, the golden age of erotica, it was a time before silicone, before Botox, before the internet, when you had to pick up a phone and dial a number. You had to go to a pay phone. If you wanted to meet somebody somewhere, there was no GPS, babe. You had to figure out how to get there your own self. And, so the women, the actors of that era were real. They had real boobs. They had real lips. They had imperfections. They were naive. It wasn't about how glamorous they looked. It was about how much they enjoyed being on screen. And that's really what I always got, is there was this sense of being genuine. You know, it just was a different time. There was this naivete that permeated our culture, and everybody just wanted to kind of love each other and have a good time. And the golden age of porn really also harkened back to a time where there were films that were made on 35mm. There were plots, there was dialogue, there was scripts, there were script girls, there was wardrobe, you know, there could be 20 or 30 people on the set to make a film. The films were big budget. They had an arc. They had characters. They had They had the character development. You were invested in the outcome of the characters. It wasn't just about the pizza delivery man, you know, knocks on the door and then, you know, that cut to a gangbang. That's not really what that was. And so I think it set the tone for a lot of other films that would come after, but then once the advent of home video and videotapes, it kind of completely changed the flavor of adult cinema of that era.
Gerard.
Yes, Mom.
Deep Throat made a star out of Linda Lovelace. Did your dad create Deep Throat for Linda Lovelace?
Absolutely. She was his muse. She was the inspiration for this film. I mean, back then, it was hard to write a role and then find somebody who could play that, to find the combination of somebody who had not only acting skills, but, you know, the sexual skills as well. Now, you know, Linda's famous, deep throat technique is not something that my father or she invented, but my father gave it a name. And that was part of the popularity of the film itself, is that it helped to open up conversations about oral sex. You know, people now had this kind of catchy word and they could talk about it. Also, the novel plot of the clitoris and the throat was something that, again, opened up a dialogue, because the truth was, back then, there were a lot of men who didn't know where the clitoris was, and even still, probably. So it might as well be in the throat. And so it got people talking about this, and couples now were going to see the film, and it became the in thing to do, where you weren't cool or you weren't hip if you hadn't seen Deep Throat. And part of that experience back then, it was a communal experience. It was a theatrical experience where you had to go to a theater in public and sit down while the lights dimmed and watch the movie all together, which is very different than the way adult content is consumed today. You know, with videotape, a lot of these films became what they used to call marital aids. In other words, it wasn't like going to see a movie. It was like you would put it on in the bedroom, you know, in the privacy of your own home, you know, as part of your own, you know, sexual experience.
Right, right. And Christar, talk to me about the title, Deep Throat. Where does this come from? What is there a story behind it? Because I'm assuming there is.
Yes. Well, what Gerard was, I think what he was getting at is when he was introduced to Linda, he saw what she could do and he was astounded that he went home and wrote the whole script in a weekend with her as the star. And it's something that our dad just kind of made up, and it really took off. And it was, like we said, it was, he made the movie after, or he wrote the script after he saw what she could do.
Mm. And if I might jump in, Mark, and,
sure,
and say that for our father, you know, he had a lot of sexual content in his films, but he would be proud to say that I don't make sex films, I make films with sex in them. And so the sex, although it's plentiful, is not usually gratuitous. In other words, the sex always drives the plot forward in his films. So in the case of Deep Throat, where he saw Linda's Deep Throat technique, he tried to create a story, tried to craft something where that Deep Throat was integral to the plot. Mm. And that was the genesis of Deep Throat.
So Christar, Deep Throat was the first porn film to make millions of dollars at the box office. It helped to create the porn industry. Burt Reynolds even fashioned his character in the 1997 movie Boogie Nights. After your dad, conservative Christian groups, anti-porn feminists, they all wanted to ban the film. You have stars like Martin Scorsese, Truman Capote, Jack Nicholson, Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, they all saw the film. Barbara Walters even mentions it in her autobiography, Audition, a Memoir. Robin was mentioning this earlier, the term porno chic. Talk to me about this term porno chic, and what does it mean to you, this term porno chic? Because you've got all these stars, that know your legacy, that have seen your dad's film, and they even wrote about it. Barbara Walters, hello.
Right.
Porno chic. Talk to me about this term.
Well, what it's about is our dad thought himself as an artist, a filmmaker and an artist. So in his films, like we were saying, there was a plot, there was a story, there was, you know, character development. So it was actually what Gerard said, it was a movie that also had sex in it. So it became something as an art piece. So then that coined the term the porno chic, because it wasn't just what they say, a fuck film. Mm-hmm. It was actually, you know, it was something to enjoy and appreciate.
Well, Mark, if I may jump in and say that the actual term porno chic was coined by Ralph Blumenthal, who was writing for the New York Times, and did an interview with our father in 1973 and used that term to describe the phenomenon that was happening at the time. And he speaks in great detail about Deep Throat and the reception of it, in that it was at a time where, you know, adult films, porn films were elevated beyond the status of, you know, stag films and loops that were shown and, you know, peep shows on 42nd Street or in the basement of the Knights of Columbus Hall. Suddenly it was a full-length feature film that people were going to see, and it had inspired and opened the door for a lot of other filmmakers who were making adult films that were of greater and greater quality, or higher quality with greater production values. And at the same time, Hollywood started to take notice, because during the 70s, you know, the studio system was now an outmoded model, and they were starting to lose money, and they were, you know, spending millions of dollars on a production that made thousands. And then they saw the Deep Throat was made for thousands and made millions. So they thought, we better get in on this. So Hollywood Films started to loosen up a bit and deal with more adult subject matter. And as porn films started to get better and better, and there was this notion at the time that the two would merge, and my father felt that people would again evolve beyond these outdated modes of hypocrisy and guilt about sex and sexuality, and that people would feel free to express themselves sexually, and that Hollywood would join together, and you would have major motion pictures that would have Hollywood stars that would go all the way.
Mm. Robin, I have a random question for you.
Yes.
Your mom was porn star and activist Gloria Leonard. Did your mom have a relationship with novelist Norman Mailer?
By golly. Yes, actually she did. They were part of a mutual admiration society. She and Norman were dear friends. They held each other in very high esteem. And there was a time where he was going to write a screenplay for her that was supposed to be like the Gone with the Wind of porn films. I think they had a crush on each other. I do not know that they were ever necessarily officially romantically involved physically, I'm sure, because they were both so cerebral and so very brilliant that I'm sure they probably in their own collective minds, in their individual minds, made love to each other. Although perhaps never, you know, in the flesh.
You never know. You never know.
You never know. Some secrets will go to the grave.
So, June 17th, 1972, five men were arrested. Watergate. Part of Watergate, the Watergate scandal, was an informant known as Deep Throat. Deep Throat turned out to be FBI Associate Director Mark Felt. And Howard Simons, the then managing editor of the Washington Post, dubbed that informant, Mark Felt, Deep Throat, referring to the type of the information that he was getting and the 1972 film Deep Throat. Gerard Jr., I'm going to start with yourself. The historic nature of your dad's film, made for what, like $25,000 and went on to make like $50 million at the box office or something? What does that mean to you?
Well, the number that was touted back in the 1970s was $600 million. Now, it's still considered to be the most profitable film of all time. And that's not to say it made more money than Titanic or what have you. Mm-hmm. It's that for the cost of making the film, the return on the investment hasn't been touched by another film since. Mm. And so our father, though, unfortunately, although he was responsible for all the creative aspect, basically wrote, directed, edited, made the music selections, wrote the lyrics to the original songs that were produced for the film. He didn't see that money. Mm. He had unscrupulous business partners. The amount of money that it started to make was unprecedented. And basically they made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And he was lucky to get out of there with his life. So he never saw the money. We didn't see the money. There was a lot of misconception when we were kids that, the success of the film was in the news all the time and all the money, you know, was part of the story. So a lot of our friends in school and people who we knew thought we were rich, which made being as poor as we were even more difficult, because not only were we, you know, struggling, but we had this conception of us as being rich and people always asking for money and like that. So there was that part of it too. And so, you know, it was a sore subject for our father, you know, till the end of his life. He appreciated the notoriety that it gave him because it allowed him to make better and better films. But he never saw the money and suffered from it.
Right. And, you know, just to interject for a moment, I know in another interview, Gerard was saying about, you know, show business and that his father and my mother were definitely in the show part of show business, meaning that they were the real entertainers and the creatives versus the business, which are those that reaped the benefits financially. And then what I would always say would, you know, rich and famous don't necessarily always go together. you can be famous and not rich. And that I think would be true for both of our parents who were these real visionaries, but yet because of circumstances never really saw the monetary benefits gains from their efforts.
Well, Robin, let's stay with yourself. And what does it mean to you in regards to the historic nature of Deep Throat, that it is so tied to American history, especially politics and Watergate?
So Deep Throat made a huge cultural impact, of course, as we know, on so many different levels and in so many aspects of American pop culture, beyond just politics. It's a word that's now become part of the lexicon in the dictionary for multiple definitions, one of which is to, of course, include in context to politics as, you know, someone who is a whistleblower. But I think that the importance of Deep Throat for these past 50 years really extends beyond just what we imagine, the kitsch factor to be, but it's kind of campy in retrospect. It's a lot of fun. But what it did was it opened the door to sexual liberation and sex positivity and female empowerment, and really perpetuated the dialogue of freedom of expression. Mm.
And Christar, for yourself, this is your legacy. This is part of your family's legacy, Christar. And the fact that it is so ingrained in American history, What does that personally mean for you?
Well, I'm very proud to be the daughter of my father, who was such a, you know, an innovator and a groundbreaker.
Sad.
And Gerard and I are in the process of also making a documentary film about the real story, because there are so many people that have taken their opportunity to tell the story, and most of it is untrue, that we really feel like the world needs to see it and know exactly what happened.
There is a documentary about the film Deep Throat, isn't there? Like Inside Deep Throat?
Yes, there is.
Yes.
Did you guys have anything to do with that?
Yes. Well, I'll jump in because I actually represented my father on that film. Annie Sprinkle, who was a dear old friend of ours, had reached out because she knew that they were in pre-production on the film. Her brother actually did some of the music that's used in the film, and she suggested that my father participate. Now, at that time, he was still very bitter about Deep Throat, that so many people, and he would say the worst kind of people, made a lot of money off of the film, and so he was really reluctant to participate in what he felt was another opportunity for people to make money off of him, and he wasn't going to see a dime of it. So I met with directors Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. I met them each individually and had long conversations with both of them, and they convinced me that their hearts were in the right place. They had a lot of respect for our father and his work. They were seeking to, you know, kind of uncover a true story behind it. So I took that back to my father, and I told him, you know, look, they're going to make this movie with or without you, but if you participate, you'll have the opportunity to tell your side of the story, and some of the truth could get out. So he actually decided to work with them, you know, and appear in the film. You know, I spoke with them about compensating him. Now, because they have their documentary filmmakers, and you know, they've made some great films in their career and have a lot of integrity. So, you know, there's no budget line to pay interviewees when you're a real documentary filmmaker, because it could skew what they say. You're not paying somebody off. You're offering them the opportunity to share their story. But I was able to make a deal with them where I provided some archival material, which these documentaries have huge budgets for, you know, for home movies and for, you know, still images and, you know, family, you know, personal effects and so forth. And also was able to bring my father in as a consultant on the film. So he actually was able to make more money, you know, if you count. They brought us out to LA for the premiere of the film, and we went to Japan to represent it when it opened overseas. And so he actually, you know, saw more money out of participating in Inside Deep Throat as he did that, or than he did from making the film Deep Throat.
Wow. And is there a timeline for your documentary?
Yes, there is, although it's been overshadowed by this release of Deep Throat, because, you know, the 50th anniversary was looming, and, you know, it's the happy ending that we want our story to have. In other words, I'm telling the story about my father, but we would like for it to end where, you know, we restore the film, reintroduce it to a new audience, and preserve it for future generations. The end. So, you know, this is, even this interview is kind of part of that story coming true. And you know, once we're through the other side of this, I can finish my documentary. We honestly don't know how it will be perceived. There's a lot of interest in the film. We are taking it around the world. We have, you know, interest in other places, but in America, it's been harder to find venues that are willing to show it or people that are willing to get behind it. So we honestly don't know how it will be perceived, but that will be part of the documentary as well. And so that's, you know, that's, we're telling a story while we're right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. Gerard Jr., Chris Starr, Robin, I have to say thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being on the show. Well said, well done, and well made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more on Deep Throat, check out the website, DamianoFilms.com.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, the sound of Deep Throat. We'll hear La 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 from the Deep Throat soundtrack written by Gerard Damiano. And I have to say, a track that I'm personally fond of.
I think it was the first time that anyone ever treated sex openly, honestly, humorously, as though we were doing nothing that we had to be ashamed about. It shows you if you're gay, it's okay to be gay. If you're heterosexual, it's okay to be heterosexual. Whatever it is that you feel like you want to do, whatever it is, don't be ashamed of it. Deep Throat did that.